Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're getting more reaction today to the president's announcement that the U.S. will restore diplomatic ties with Cuba after decades of isolating the country. Speaking on CBS this morning, former Secretary of State Colin Powell called the move a good first step toward change in Cuba.
They're not going to get off the sanctions list anytime soon. Congress isn't going to do that. But it's good to have an ambassador there who could tell the Cubans, this is what comes if you start to respond in a positive way.
Meanwhile, there are people in both major political parties who disagree. Congressman-elect Carlos Curbelo was just elected to represent parts of South Florida. He has called the move reckless. He's a Republican born to Cuban exiles, and he's with us now. Congressman, what's your objection to the change in relationship with Cuba?
What has the Castro government done to deserve these unilateral concessions? I can tell you a few things they've done in recent years. Last year, they were caught shipping arms illegally to North Korea. They continue oppressing their own people, imprisoning those that disagree with them politically. This is the reward that the Obama administration gives the Cuban government for all of this conduct. What happened yesterday, what was announced, is wonderful for the Cuban government. It's bad for the Cuban people, and it is certainly very damaging to U.S. National security interests, both in the short term and in the long term.
Aren't those things, though, that you're talking about, things that you could say about a lot of other countries that the U.S. has a perfectly good relationship with, including, by the way, China?
Yeah. I mean, the United States years ago decided that it was going to abandon the Chinese people in their fight for freedom. And now we've done it with Cuba. Is that something we should be proud of? I don't know. I don't think so.
So do you think we should not have the relationship with China that we do?
Well, our relationship with China is what it is. And the problem with all these changes in policy is that oftentimes they are irreversible. And it would be very difficult to modify our relationship with China because we've become so dependent on them. And by the way, there are many risks to our China policy today. China's building a very strong military. We see them flexing their muscle in Asia. We see them not cooperating with the United States on a number of international priorities. So I think there are a lot of issues with the China relationship, and it isn't necessarily a model of how we should approach every single dictatorial regime that oppresses its own people and that opposes American interests throughout the globe.
And what about the argument that President Obama has been making that this was a policy that was going on for decades and it didn't achieve the result that the U.S. wanted? Why keep trying it if it doesn't work?
Well, the purpose of our sanctions policy was never regime change. I never thought that American sanctions against Cuba would topple the Castro government. Cuba will change whenever the Cuban people either get rid of the Castros or whenever the Castros are out of the picture. But for over 50 years, the occupant of the White House, no matter Republican or Democrat, had stood in solidarity with the Cuban people, with the victims of the Castro regime. Today, we woke up in an America where the United States president was no longer standing with the victims of the Castro regime. Instead, he was sitting at the table with dictators, with the same men that still have blood on their hands. So it's an American tragedy. It's a defeat for democracy, for human rights. And you're going to see that there's a very strong bipartisan coalition in Congress that is going to work every day to oppose all of the actions the president announced yesterday.
Well, beyond opposing the actions of the president, though, what would you like the U.S. to do with regards to Cuba? What would be the best policy in your view?
Well, there are a number of instruments at Congress's disposal, and I have to meet with my colleagues on both sides of the aisle to figure out what the best way to move forward is. I know Senators Lindsey Graham and Marco Rubio have already discussed defunding all of the policy changes announced by the administration, including the establishment of an embassy. So there are a number of instruments at our disposal, and I am sure they will be all utilized at the appropriate moment.
But how does opposing what the president is trying to do help the Cuban people? In other words, are you just in favor of the status quo? Would you just like us to continue all of the policies that have been in place for decades?
What I'm in favor of is having a policy of standing in solidarity with the Cuban people and of having a policy of peace through strength throughout the world. What the president did yesterday fits perfectly into his foreign policy agenda. He has rewarded our enemies and punished our allies. This is the same president that is at the table with the mullahs in Iran. This is the same president who drew red lines in Syria and then ignored them. So this is all consistent with the president's agenda of appeasing evil dictators. We saw the Russian reset a few years ago. That was the initiative of President Obama and Secretary Clinton. We've seen how successful the Russian reset has been. I'm predicting a similar outcome in this Cuba reset.
Well, the president's defenders would say that the opposite policies of taking a hardline approach were not successful either in achieving U.S. aims.
Of course they've been successful. We have denied the Cuban dictatorship, the men who have assassinated and imprisoned innocent people in Cuba. We had a policy that opposed their interests, that denied them the billions and billions of dollars in U.S. tourism and trade. That policy was effective because we don't like to reward our enemies in this country, at least those of us that believe in a strong America that leads with a clear moral voice in the world. So that policy was a success. To define success as causing regime change is quite arrogant, actually, and it assumes that the United States can unilaterally, through its policy, short of an invasion, determine what happens in other countries. You know, there's 190 other countries in the world that have full commercial and diplomatic relations with Cuba. What has that done for the Cuban people? Are they free?
Incoming freshman Republican Congressman Carlos Curbelo of Florida, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Well, Congressman Curbelo is one of many in South Florida who believe the president is making a mistake in opening up closer relations with Cuba, but others say it's a long time coming. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, WLRN's Rick Stone reports from Miami.
In Hialeah, Jadre de Armas was getting lunch at the Tropical Restaurant. She's the U.S.-born daughter of Cuban exiles. Her mother arrived in 1966.
My dad got here a little later, I think in the 70s, and he was, like, hardcore fed up with it. He tried escaping three times, actually got jailed for it once.
De Armas is 37, sells real estate, and like a lot of the younger Cuban generation in South Florida, she doesn't think normalizing relations with Cuba is such a bad thing.
Maybe I'm a little bit more modern, I don't know. Even though I know the suffering my parents had with the government, Cubans in exile that actually came from over there a very long time ago, probably think more along the lines where the government is going to take advantage of it and not the people.
That could be her own father, De Armas admits. He's an angry exile, a typical Cuban hardliner, but he's changing.
We have Saturday backyard politics where my dad talks about what's going on in Cuba and how it's never going to change. And he mentioned recently, oh, let them lift the embargo regardless. Those were his thoughts.
But in Miami's Little Havana, white-hot exile politics were on display. The Versailles Restaurant is the unofficial town square where old-line Cuban exiles gather for political events. Hundreds were there to wave signs and shout their opposition.
The situation is Obama is conspiracy.
Miguel Saavedra's take was that Obama had conspired with the Castro government to lift the embargo for reasons that have nothing to do with democracy and human rights. He said the negotiations broke the U.S.'s own rules against negotiating with terrorists. Laura Vianello of the anti-Castro group Vigilia Mambisa said the Cubans have done nothing to earn diplomatic recognition and some relief from the embargo. She said the Castro government is a military dictatorship that has not changed since the revolution.
Every day, you can see women being beaten up, the ladies in white, you saw them daily. So why? This is just because of a small group of American interests wants to make a business in Cuba.
Miami Mayor Tomas Regalado made an appearance at the Versailles. He said Obama appeared to have forgotten the whole idea behind the embargo, which he understands was to pressure the Cuban government to allow free elections and respect human rights.
That has not happened at all. So the United States has given a lot in exchange for nothing. And I think that that's why people feel betrayed.
The diplomatic opening happened in conjunction with American Alan Gross's release after 5 years in a Cuban prison. That makes Regalado uneasy.
What I fear is that other countries are going to start arresting U.S. citizens to blackmail the U.S. and get whatever they want.
If you're on a diet for 54 years and you're still overweight, it's time to try Plan B.
In Key West, closer to Cuba than Miami, City Commissioner Tony Yanis called it the best Christmas ever. He came from Cuba with his family when he was 10 years old.
And so to the naysayers, I say we've tried the other plan for half a century. Let's try this for 5 years.
And back up in Little Havana, there was general agreement that a new approach to Cuba is called for, but Laura Vianello hasn't seen the right plan B yet.
Something has to change the right way, but not this way, sir, because this is only for the few. This is not for the nation.
For Here and Now, I'm Rick Stone in Miami.
And WLRN reporter Nancy Klinger contributed to that story from Key West. We have a note on another story we're following. Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of young undocumented immigrants in Arizona who are asking for the right to drive in that state. Arizona Governor Jan Brewer had tried to block so-called Dreamers from getting driver's licenses after President Obama granted them a reprieve from deportation with that executive order back in 2012. But in not hearing a case, the court effectively is allowing the Dreamers to drive. 21-year-old Carla Chavarria was one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. She was brought to the country illegally as a child and received a work permit under the Obama program, now plans on getting behind the wheel in a matter of days. She told KJZZ in Phoenix she was cautiously optimistic.
I'm real excited. I won't think I will be able to believe it until I have the license in my hand. But again, I'm very excited. This is a big win for our community.
The ACLU says the ruling will help young people get to work, contribute to their families. State officials had said the president's executive order violated federal law. Arizona and Nebraska were the only states that had refused to issue driver's licenses to Dreamers. We'll continue to follow this story.
Here's something to think about. People under the age of 38 have only experienced one presidential election in this country that didn't feature a Bush or a Clinton running for president or vice president.
Read my lips. No new taxes.
I said we'd cut the deficit in half in 4 years. We cut it by 60%.
This is a remarkable moment in the life of our nation. Never has the promise of prosperity been so vivid.
This is a fight for the future, and it's a fight we must win together.
Highlights of some presidential elections over the last few decades. Well, with the news this week that Jeb Bush is actively exploring a presidential bid and Hillary Clinton is expected to run again, let's bring in George Edwards. He's a presidential scholar and professor of political science at Texas A&M, and he joins us from KAMU in College Station. Professor, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Well, what do you think it says about us as a country that we may indeed have another election that features a Bush and a Clinton?
Well, I think there are several interesting aspects of this. First is that if you have famous parents or famous relatives or famous husband, you have an advantage in politics. First of all, the name recognition is very important. And normally, someone who wants to run for president has to spend a lot of time and a lot of money just getting known as an entity, get people to know that they actually exist. If Jeb Bush were named Jeb Smith and were a successful governor of Florida, he'd have a much more difficult time than he will have now as Jeb Bush. Similarly, Hillary Clinton, if she were Hillary Smith and not married to the President of the United States, would not have had the launch pad into the Senate race in New York. And after that, of course, she was on her own. She was a successful senator and then Secretary of State, so she was able to establish her own identity.
So name recognition helps, but absolutely, we didn't want a monarchy. Isn't that the whole point of our system, is that anyone can make it? That's the American dream.
Well, that's certainly the American dream, and to some extent, it's certainly true. But another advantage of being well-known and being well-connected is being able to raise money. And that's certainly the mother's milk of politics. It's certainly key today. And if you are part of a dynasty, you have a built-in advantage in raising funds. And that is very, very important. And there's probably also some residual political organization out there that is composed of people who helped your relatives, who have family loyalties, And that also gives you an extra push up the ladder.
But does it depress you that that's where we are?
It doesn't depress me if people are competent. And I think in this instance, Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush are two very competent people.
But there may be a lot of people who are competent who aren't named Clinton or Bush.
That's certainly true. There are plenty of competent people. And it's just a fact of life that some people have an advantage over other people. I don't think there's much we could do about that.
What are the disadvantages, if any, of being part of a political dynasty?
Well, there may be baggage. Let's take Jeb Bush's case. His father, and I have great respect for his father, but his father was defeated in his effort to be reelected. His brother left office under a cloud because of a mishandled war in Iraq and, of course, the onset of the Great Recession. So those aren't happy days, and needless to say, he will not be wanting to emphasize those aspects of his family's political history. So there's baggage there. In Hillary Clinton's case, there was so much demonization of Bill Clinton and also some of her over the years, and of course, particularly in the 1990s, that there's a lot of people who will just look at her as the Wicked Witch of the North or something, and she's going to find it more difficult to break through to those people because of that baggage.
So do you think then it's a net positive or a net negative to be part of the dynasty?
I think it's a net positive. Many of the people who don't like you would never consider supporting you, would never support someone of your party anyhow. So that's really not much of a loss. On the other hand, the name recognition, the access to the absolutely necessary funds, and political organization are all great advantages in politics.
Now, as we said, in the last few decades, we've only had one election in which there was not a Clinton or a Bush in the mix at all. And we've had a couple of elections where a Clinton or a Bush was not on the national ticket in the end. And the one that I'm thinking of is 2008. Of course, Hillary Clinton ran against Barack Obama but lost in the primary. And when he ran against John McCain, the turnout was record. Doesn't that tell you that the country is more interested in hearing from new people than voting for people that they know pretty well?
Well, I'm not sure that I would reach that conclusion. Certainly, there's some variation in turnout, and I think Barack Obama was able to inspire a lot of people to get to the polls, and particularly people who normally don't vote, and that's younger people and minorities who vote at a much lower rate than other people. But I'm not sure that we should view that as a rejection of well-known names or of Hillary Clinton. I think if Hillary Clinton is on the ticket, for example, that this will be quite inspirational to many women.
Yeah.
Since she is a viable candidate to be the first female president of the United States.
Well, do you think then that we just go in these waves? Sometimes we want to hear from somebody new, and sometimes we want a good old standby that we know.
Well, I'm not sure if it's the new versus the old. Certainly there are times when we just want change. But I think in this instance, we have two people who are very competent who have emerged at least to be viable candidates for their party's nomination. There's a long way to go. And I don't think we should assume anything as far as them winning the nomination. There'll be a very difficult fight. Certainly Jeb Bush will have many opponents. And he is not in the center of the Republican Party, so there'll be a challenge for him. I think he's probably up to the challenge, but it will be a challenge.
Now, you're a presidential scholar, so I want to ask you, let's go back to the other examples of this in history. John Quincy Adams and John Adams, and then the cousins Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt and FDR. Is there anything that Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton can learn from either of those cases in terms of managing a political dynasty to their benefit?
Well, John Quincy Adams did not have a happy presidency. Actually, John Adams didn't have a happy presidency either, and of course was defeated for re-election, as was his son, John Quincy Adams. So there's nothing that you can assume, you can't assume success.
Do you think John Quincy Adams could have been elected without John Adams having been president?
Well, I think that John Quincy Adams' initial connection to government and a dedication to public service certainly was related strongly to the fact that his father was one of the founders of the nation. But John Quincy Adams was also an extremely competent person and had very substantial experience, diplomatic experience, and was very dedicated to public service. Indeed, after he left the presidency, he became famous for fighting the good fight because he was elected to the House of Representatives.
Right.
We wouldn't expect presidents to step down, so to speak, and did, and was fought slavery until literally till the day he died.
George Edwards, a presidential scholar and professor of political science at Texas A&M University. Professor Edwards, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
The credibility of the International Soccer Governing Board, FIFA, is being questioned again today after Michael Garcia, the chief ethics investigator for FIFA, resigned because the report he did examining the criticized 2018 and 2022 World Cup bidding processes was smothered and, he says, mischaracterized. FIFA says to release it would violate the organization's ethics code. Mike Pesca is Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the podcast The Gist at Slate.com. And so, Mike, FIFA says releasing this would violate its code. Garcia seems to be saying, what ethics code? Remind us what some of the criticism of FIFA was.
Yeah, to hear FIFA citing an ethics code is to hear most American soccer ignorant fans talking about the offside rule, right? They don't seem to go together. So how was it that Qatar and Russia were awarded their bids? So much questions that weren't answered even in this report. But essentially, FIFA cleared itself, we think, because Michael Garcia, this former U.S. attorney, put together this report and he says you should release the full report. FIFA won't do it. Garcia says that that's a whitewash. So Garcia is saying, I did a lot of work. I think I proved something. FIFA isn't having the courage to let all of that out. Garcia is cutting his ties with FIFA.
Yeah. And what you said, as you said, this was a 42-page summary of the 430-page corruption report that FIFA released. And it was widely considered to be inaccurate. And when you say corruption, you know, people paying for bids, I mean, how did mm-hmm. We spoke about this. How did Qatar get a World Cup when they're 120 degrees most of the time? Garcia is asking for an outside group. He says the governing committee can't fix itself.
Right. And there is an international body, the Court for Arbitration for Sport, but Garcia is not appealing to that. There is the possibility that U.S. investigators, actual government investigators in places like the U.S. and the U.K. could look into this because it could run up against rules of international trade. Maybe that's a long shot at this point. You know, soccer remains so unbelievably popular and these tournaments are white elephants for the host countries, but there seems to be no shortage of people putting their hands up, and maybe they're the sort of countries that need to burnish their reputation. We've seen this with the Olympics, right? Fewer and fewer countries are bidding for the Olympics because they're realizing it's a white elephant. But places like Qatar, places like Russia think that the World Cup can burnish their image, can put them on the world stage, and they're probably right. That's how much people like soccer.
So Chief Ethics Investigator for FIFA takes a stand, and we are seeing others. Segue alert here, because we just want to talk briefly with you about the athletes who've worn the I Can't Breathe t-shirts for Eric Garner, his last words while being held in a chokehold by police, or athletes who've held their hands up for Mike Brown of Ferguson. This past Sunday, Andrew Hawkins, wide receiver for the Cleveland Browns, wore a t-shirt that said Justice for Tamir Rice and John Crawford III. This is the 12-year-old boy shot in Cleveland, and the man shot by Cleveland police in the Walmart but for carrying a product, an air rifle that he was looking at. How are league executives responding?
Oh, they're doing the right thing. I mean, this is a moment. In sports, the history of sports, normally, it was not normally, but for many years, it was seen as, you know, the toy section of the newspaper. And then, of course, in the 60s, in the civil rights moment, there was a moment, 1968 Mexico Olympics, John Carlos, Tommy Smith, and things that Muhammad Ali said. But then it subsided. And the big quote is Michael Jordan saying, Republicans buy shoes, too. But now we're seeing a coming together of Derrick Rose and Reggie Bush and LeBron James, a lot of black athletes, even international. And the leagues are not taking the bait of a number of police unions who've criticized this. And they're saying it's within their rights to make these statements. It's not been distracting from the games. It's mostly in pre-games. So I think they're taking the correct stance.
Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst. He also hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com, catching us up on all things, in this case, in the sports world, when it comes to taking a stand. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
Tonight, Stephen Colbert is signing off after 10 seasons of The Colbert Report. He's going out with a touch of symbolism with his final guest, Grimmy the Grim Reaper. Last week, President Obama visited the show.
Let's talk about the Keystone XL pipeline, all right? Congress is going to pass that. Congress is going to pass that. Now the Republicans are in there. House and the Senate are going to pass it. The American people want it. It's going to create jobs. State Department says it's not going to raise the pollution in the atmosphere. You're going to sign that, right?
Obviously, these young people weren't polled.
No, they're chanting, do it.
Colbert, as we know, will be heading to the Late Show on CBS, where he'll take over for David Letterman next year, but probably not as the satirical Colbert character, the mock conservative and uber patriot. Julia Cunningham has been taking a look at the power and legacy of Colbert. She's co-host of News and Notes on Entertainment Weekly Radio on Sirius XM. Julia, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeremy.
Well, and before we start here, I want to listen back to an interview that Stephen Colbert did with Robert Siegel on NPR back in 2005, right when he was starting the show. Here he is.
Hopefully it's going to be a program that, with its will toward justice, will slowly change the great ship of destiny.
And if we were to think of another talk show that is in existence that this one might take on head-to-head, what would be a model that you'd be
attracted? I'm really gunning for you, Siegel. But if I had to have a second choice, as The Daily Show is to sort of like a headline-driven news, this will be to O'Reilly or Hannity or Scarborough Country. Is it going to be the Colbert Nation? You know, I think it's pretty obvious The Daily Show is just a tool of the liberal elite. I just think John's been co-opted by the media. And we're going to bring it in a way that I think maybe he doesn't have the courage to anymore. He's too much of a darling these days to really to stick it to the rest of the industry.
He's the most trusted man in broadcasting, they say. Huh?
So was Cronkite.
Yes.
I think I've made my point.
So, Julia, what do you think he did accomplish? It does sound like that outline that he gave back in 2005 is what the show became.
No, that is 100% what it became. I think the great thing about Stephen Colbert is that he really hit in a time, you know, post 9/11, when there was an extreme interest in news again. Not that the news sort of wanes, but I think people really cared about wanting to be in on the news and know sort of what's happening. But also have to have it like broken down. Like I still will look sometimes at The Economist or Wall Street Journal and think, I mean, I'm going to pretend like I know what's happening right now. I don't. I know I can learn it from Stephen Colbert. He was smart enough to hit what I like to call the two C's. He hit both campuses and career people. Mm. He knew how to sort of relate to the stoner sitting on a couch, also the person who's actually running a company.
Well, what do you think he brought, though, that Jon Stewart didn't? Because a lot of those things you could say about Stewart as well.
Sure. No, I think that's totally fair. I think with Jon Stewart, it's really straightforward and he pushes sort of stories where I think Stephen Colbert, with the sort of overdrawn sarcasticness, that sort of vibe where he gives off pushing, he allows for more discovery versus I think people know to tune in to Jon Stewart. I think people feel like they found Stephen Colbert and like he sort of belongs to them. I think there's sort of that vibe with his sort of almost like off-putting nature. I think people sort of actually grabbed onto that in a different way that I don't think people were expecting.
Well, and he has a power to him that has extended beyond the TV show. He's led movements movements. It is thanks to him that Merriam-Webster's 2006 Word of the Year was truthiness. How do you think he became such a cultural icon in a way that even Jon Stewart didn't?
I think in some ways we have to remember that Stephen Colbert's history is in improv. And a lot of the push of improv is planting seeds. Like I think he sort of allowed for a slippery slope with this sort of ridiculousness in this way where, sure, he says in that sort of early interview saying, yeah, this is a Colbert nation. But he didn't know that at that point. He didn't know that people were actually going to respond the way they did. And once he had the sort of extreme love from this audience, he thought, yeah, why don't we have this bridge in Hungary named after me? Why not try it? You know, and it's like, oh, we can get that. Why don't we get something named from NASA after me? Oh, NASA's not going to allow it. We're going to push this further. It all starts from one tiny seed.
Well, and he also was unafraid. And I remember him at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, made a lot of people very uncomfortable when he did a send up there on the President of the United States. Also, here he is right after the Newtown massacre in Connecticut. He took on gun control through the lens of his NRA-loving character.
Join me in standing up against any actual knowledge about guns. Let the CDC know they can take our ignorance when they pry it from our cold, dead minds.
That's a real punch there, Julia.
It's extreme. You know, even going back to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, I mean, these are ballsy statements that I think people want to hear but are too afraid to actually have said or even sort of rally behind it. I know, especially when watching the White House Correspondents' Dinner, some of my favorite moments are more is when the camera's on the audience and you see these women literally clutching their pearls because they're so shocked. But people want it to be said, but we need sort of a character to do it in sometimes. And I think that's why it's easy to sort of rely on him. And I think there's going to be a huge gap when the show actually goes off the air tonight.
Well, and as we said, he is going to be heading to The Late Show. And I want to listen to him with David Letterman on The Late Show. Here he is.
They could have just as easily hired another boob like me. Ah. But they didn't. They hire a guy.
They hired a boob like me.
No, 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 no.
Every boob is like a snowflake, Dave. We're all unique in our own way.
Julia, what is the new Colbert going to be like? This is the big question. Is he going to keep some aspects of his character on the Colbert Report and take it with him to The Late Show? Or is he just going to be Stephen Colbert?
We honestly, we don't know what's going to happen yet. You know, there hasn't been sort of like a tease. Like, we knew when Jimmy Fallon was going to transition, it was going to be something similar to what he was previously doing. I don't think Colbert can take this character. I think when the Grim Reaper comes tonight, there's going to be a killing off of the Stephen Colbert character, and we will finally see this real Stephen Colbert. It sort of came out of nowhere that he was announced as the successor for David Letterman. I don't think a lot of people had sort of thrown that name around, but obviously they had been working for months. I mean, this isn't like a slight against CBS, but I mean, they had to have really put some time and thought and energy into making sure this was the right decision. It's a big deal to have someone take over Late Show with David Letterman. And I would have been curious to know if they did dry run-throughs. I wonder if there were poster boards about what shows would be like. I think it's going to be genuinely completely different than what we know. I think he's going to do really strong interviews, and I think he is going to do a monologue, and I think it's still going to be biting towards news and politics, but I don't think we're going to see the camp factor that we sort of see in the Colbert Report.
We will be watching, and we'll have to wait and see. Julia Cunningham, co-host of News and Notes on Entertainment Weekly Radio on Sirius XM. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.
Podcasts are all the rage, in part because listeners can listen whenever they want, but also podcasters can say whatever they want. It's not broadcast, and that will work well for the two hosts of the new podcast, Dear Sugar Radio. It began as an advice column on the online site The Rumpus, written by Sugar, a woman with a troubled past. Turns out she was a he, writer Steve Almond, frequent here and now contributor and author. So then Dear Sugar was taken over by Cheryl Strayed, a real woman with a troubled past, including heroin use. Her memoir, Wild, is the basis for the new film starring Reese Witherspoon. Well, now Steve and Cheryl are doing the podcast Dear Sugar Radio together, produced by our mother station, WBUR. Here they discuss a woman who's wondering if she should stay with a man not her intellectual equal.
Maybe she's told him that she feels all this about him, but I doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
I think he'd be heading for the door and saying, listen, I'm going to find a relationship where I'm more esteemed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do think, you know, even though, you know, our first impulse is like, wait, she loves him and she's happy. They should be together. I agree with you. I think that you have to choose the partner you want to be with.
And now Cheryl Strayed joins us by Skype from Oregon. Steve Almond joins us in the studio. Steve, welcome. Cheryl, where do you find the time? Welcome to you as well.
Thanks.
You know, I like to just be on radio shows in my free time.
Yes, right. As you premiere a movie. And then this podcast. Steve, let's start with you. When you first conceived it, how did you want it to be? There are advice columns. Right. What did you want?
Well, I didn't get there, but The Promised Land for me was an advice column that was not about dispensing advice and feeling assurance, but actually heading just in the opposite direction towards doubt and shame, which I think are really the path to truth for people and really what people need when they're troubled in some way, troubled enough to write strangers.
Well, and you decided after a year, you weren't the guy to
no,
be the girl.
Sugar. I was stinking it up, honestly. I mean, I was writing something that was trying to be clever rather than trying to be truthful. And Cheryl very eloquently and in the beautiful manner that she does, just started to write the column that I really had envisioned, smart to the truth, but also so radically empathic with
it. And Cheryl, why was it, as Steve said, that you had an empathy and an understanding of what some of the people were writing? Just a little bit about your background that you bring to the advice column.
I've had a number of experiences, some of them incredibly fortunate. I had such a deeply good mother who loved me well, but she died when she was 45. So, you know, I had the brightness of that love and the darkness of that profound loss. I had a father who isn't in my life and hasn't been since I was a kid, who was abusive. I've been married and divorced. I've lived a lot. I grew up in poverty. I knew the struggle of, you know, being poor in America. I also knew the victory of doing things like, you know, going off and getting an education. And I do think that I've drawn on that full range of experience in offering advice.
Yeah.
Part of what the podcast is about is, and this is actually true of literature, you just want to spend time in the presence of a wise, dangerous mind. And I love spending time with Cheryl, listening to her put her mind and heart to somebody's troubles. I love just also in the podcast form that there's a certain kind of intimacy that really people are hungering for, because people are really lonely and they mostly want to know that they're not alone with their crazy. And Cheryl and I are both crazy. And so it's important for us to be, I feel, for us to be in the same room and for that kind of intimacy or room tone almost to be welcoming the listener in, as opposed to the armature of even something that's on the printed page where it's abstracted, or a radio show where there's a format. Like, we just want to be in people's, like, we want them to feel like they're there with us, because they are.
I was going to say, too, is I think that so much of what both Steve and I do, you know, in our writing as Dear Sugar, but also in the other work we write, what I'm always most interested in is grappling right, to get at the truth, not asserting that I know what the truth is, but seeking it. I loved this idea of sitting in a room and trying to figure things out with somebody.
Well, what are some of the topics?
One that's coming out that's fascinating is a woman who's addicted to painkillers, high-functioning woman who's addicted to painkillers and is trying to grapple with that, even as her life on a very surface way is going great, whether to have a third child, struggling with the sins, you know, horrible, painful sins of a father who's, you know, chronically unfaithful and really undermine this young woman's faith in monogamy and her own ability to love. I mean, it's really, I think it's going to run the gamut.
Well, pick up on one of them. This is all letters that you get or emails, and you read a letter from a woman who is thinking about a third child. This hit a nerve for both of you. Cheryl, you have two children. Steve, you have three.
Yes, at latest count.
And I'll start with Steve. You're very frank about when your wife was pregnant for the third time, you were afraid.
Well, I was terrified. And this is the thing, is that what most people really want to know isn't to say, you know, here's our prescription, but to say, I too live in this doubt and this uncertainty, and there's no right answer. There's just the path you take and facing up to what it's going to mean. And for us, you know, Cheryl thought a lot about whether to have a third child, and she, her husband, discussed it. My wife and I, like with many things, we had unconscious urges and we sort of tripped and fell into it.
And Cheryl, for you, if you talk to someone who's addicted to painkillers, I'm imagining you bring something personal to that.
Sure. I mean, I think that we always bring ourselves to any number of the questions.
Well, it's just fascinating, because I remember in answering that question, I was, you know, prattling on in my manner. And I really, Cheryl just made this basic point. Hey, Steve, she's an addict. You know what addicts do. They lie. They lie to mm-hmm. themselves and they lie to the people around them. And
well,
I realized.
You called the person seeking help from you a liar.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Well, because what she did is she made her case right. for all the reasons that she should actually keep on using this drug. I mean, in her letter, she made a really winning case.
Exactly, which
I
bought.
which Steve was sort of like, well, maybe this is okay. I remember there's a scene that I had written that didn't end up in my memoir, Wild. I was writing about this time of my life where I had begun using heroin, and I never became a full-blown addict, but I was, you know, really using it in a way that was incredibly destructive. And I called Narcotics Anonymous. And when I called them, what I really truly believed in my own messed up little mind at that time is that the guy on the phone would tell me that I was right and that my friends
right.
were wrong.
Yes.
And that actually it was fine that I was using heroin, as I would say, recreationally. The guy was so gruff, and he wouldn't even hardly let me finish my sentences. He just said, you can't use heroin. If you continue to use, you will become an addict and your life will be ruined. And I hung up the phone. I was so stung and angry and outraged. I thought he was wrong. And his words have just rung through my mind all of these years. Of course, he was right. I just didn't know how to hear it at that moment in my life.
Yeah.
So that's partly what's going to happen. We essentially say, well, here's what we think really is what you're saying, but you can't even see it in your own letter. Yeah. We already have the evidence. But for the most part, I think Cheryl would agree, people want permission to feel what they're feeling. They don't want an answer. They want permission, essentially, to feel what they're feeling and to know that they're in a process of struggle. And they're not alone in that. And there is, with enough mercy, there's an eventual path out of it. But it's no quick fix.
They also want to hear the truth from people who don't have a direct stake
right.
in what they do with that truth.
Right.
If Steve came to me and asked me advice about his marriage, for example, I would give him a different kind of advice than I would a stranger, because I know his wife and I know him and we have an ongoing relationship and there's a different dynamic at play.
Right.
And that's the beauty of asking a stranger for advice. There aren't personal consequences to what you might have to say about that person's situation.
Author Cheryl Strayed, her current book is Wild. You can see it on the big screen as a film. Steve Ammann, his book is Against Football, which hasn't gotten any reaction at all, this idea that we should give up American football. And now both hosts of the podcast, Dear Sugar Radio. Thank you both.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Well, Jeremy, I might write in, but I will be Susie from Boise.
Well, we should say, while we're talking podcasts, today is, of course, the last day of the wildly popular podcast Serial.
That's right.
And if you're looking for another podcast, you know Here and Now has a podcast, too.
There's us.
We're right on iTunes.
Here and Now
is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now. I feel so sad.